Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Tom. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Russ. How about you?
Fine. I see a dinosaur nose sticking in the window. You might want to peek over there and make... Oh. Tom usually has dinosaurs all over the place, but for whatever reason, they've all snuck out of the room and gone up to his boys' rooms or something. I'm not entirely certain at this point where they all went.
Fun fact, I actually started rereading Jurassic Park that I read when I was younger. And so we're talking about dinosaurs. I'm reading about dinosaurs. It's all great.
Yeah, it's all great. Yeah, I just finished reading a book called Dedicated, which was a very interesting book about how we all go into infinite browsing mode and never dedicate ourselves to anything, and how important it is to dedicate yourself to something and give up on the fear of missing out, which I think is very important and is very hard for me to even deal with sometimes. Well, today we are joined by Alistair's backyard. Alistair is in a tent in his backyard. I mean, you know, his wife just kicked him out and he's got the little camp lantern hanging there above him and the trees and...
Exactly. I'm isolating in my backyard.
Did you tell your wife you were going to hang out with Russ White? And she's like, get out of here.
Yeah, something like that.
Exactly.
And then John Frazier, who has been on the program, has been on History of Networking. I don't know if he's ever been on the Hedge or not. But John, where are you now physically? What state and city and stuff like that?
I'm in Morrisville, so Raleigh, North Carolina.
Oh, that's right. You moved when you went to work for Cumulus, and now you're over at Fastly, yep. But still in Morrisville. Cool. So over by the airport. And I'm still by the airport, just a different airport.
Where did you go to in Tennessee?
I'm in Knoxville.
Okay.
Yeah.
K-Vegas.
Merrville. Everybody says it Maryville, but it's not. It's Merrville. There's even stickers that say Merrville.
Merrville.
But then the town next door is called Louisville, and they don't say it Louisville. They say Louisville. It's very, very confusing. It's like when you go to Atlanta and they say, you're looking for Ponce de Leon Avenue, and they say, oh, you mean Ponce de Leon. And you're like,
yeah, right.
Oh, please stop that. That is very sad. So let's start out with this. We wanted to talk about defects and code and 0 days and how things last and what goes on. And part of this is going to run into the complexity of our code bases and how crazy things are out there. So, John, there is a defect that you discovered in FR routing. Why don't you tell us about the defect and how you found it, and then we can talk about the history a little bit.
Well, I can't take credit for finding it.
Oh, sure you can. you're here by yourself on the hedge. Nobody else will ever hear this. It's fine. So,
when I went over to Vendor Space and was working for Cumulus, of course, you know, I was excited because they were running FR routing and I had history with Zebra and then Quagga, and you know, it was a familiar code base.
Yeah, so. Don't brag about how old you are.
Yeah, I'm not bragging. I've been there a couple of months, and we had a customer that was doing some really simple yet aggressive show commands against their devices. And about, I don't know, every 45 minutes or so, the device would crash, or at least the control plane would, and we couldn't figure out why. And this was a fairly high-profile customer. So, of course, there are the dual Dons and Quentin were trying to track down what was going on, and then I was trying to track down what was going on while also fielding calls with this customer who was not happy at all about what was going on. And after a few weeks, we're sitting at lunch back in the day when, you know, you could be around people in the office, and I'm sitting across from the dual Dons and Quentin, and I sit down and Quentin looks at me and he goes, hey, John, we finally, you know, found the problem. We found the problem and we've actually got a patch in for that bug. And I was like, really, what was it? So he says something like, you know, anytime the return in this show command was 2,300 bytes plus or minus 4, it would cause an exception and crash. And I remember being so indignant about this. And I look across the table and I'm like, what idiot wrote that code? And everybody on the other side of the table, because they told everybody but me about this. So now the entire company that is around in the Raleigh offices are looking at me going, what kind of idiot wrote that code? And Quentin looks at me and he goes, you. He's like, what are you talking about? And he said, I've actually got the commit. It's 21 years old.
It's 21 years old. So, you know, it's very interesting that because, and a lot of times you don't even know this is going to happen. I mean, the story I always tell is that I was once working in customer network and they asked me for a special feature. And so I coded it and it was an EIGRP. And I just coded it up and gave it to them as a special and said, you know, go try this in your lab and see if it works. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I got a call, a page, and this is back in those days. And there was a crash in X25 in a special image I had built. And I thought, that's really odd because I've never even touched X25 in my life. Like, I wouldn't even know where to start. And it turned out that me touching EIGRP code had somehow caused a crash. And they had decided to run the code in production.
Ooh.
So it's interesting because, I mean, these things happen and you almost don't realize the frequency with which these things happen. And maybe, I don't know, is it worth spending some time talking through exactly how this happened and what the problem was, or I don't know.
I would be fascinated because the number doesn't sound like it's any one of the usual culprits, right? So I'm trying to figure out what caused it to be in that particular number space size and what you were doing. So bust it on out, John. As Ross said, it's not going to go any further than the four of us. You'll be fine.
So I reached out to some mutual friends because I don't have Quentin's direct contact information and I don't have the commit. You know, for a couple of weeks, I've been trying to track this commit down. I've looked through my Gmail archive because I've been running Gmail. I actually imported all of my previous mails into Gmail when I switched over to Gmail.
Oh, so I've got, you're one of those. Oh
my goodness. I've got a Gmail archive going back to like 97. But I couldn't find it. So I know that it had something to do with me prettying up or trying to pretty up an output so that it was more easily consumable by me, you know, the idiot that's writing this code. And I wasn't, and I'm still not a classically trained programmer, especially when it comes to see, I can program myself into a wet paper bag, but not out of one. And I'm sure that I had just gone through and I'd found the routine and I'd made a little, you know, a couple of changes to it. And I'd make some changes and go into VTY shell and see what the output looks like. Okay. Doesn't look like what I want. Okay. Let's make another change, remake the code, go back into VTY shell. Okay. Does it look like what I want? And, you know, obviously there was some bounds that were being not checked, or, you know, I made assumptions and it came down to, I was reusing somebody else's code and it was probably importing some other routines. It's probably similar to your EIGRP change, killing X11. There was probably some mutual library or some mutual routine that, somebody didn't write a test for, and, you know, some change that you made now violated what they were looking for over on the X25 side. that's what I suspect, you know, just hearing your description, and I'm almost certain that's what happened to me, because none of it was my original code. I was just going in and jacking somebody else's code up.
That's fascinating, because I don't think we realize just how complex a lot of this stuff is, and how hard it is to write some of this code that we're talking about.
I think it's really interesting. One of the metrics that at least I commonly use is what runtime is on this or that code. It's one of the things to consider, right? How long has it been in production? Who's been using it? Generally, higher runtime equals better. But there is another end to that, which is how many years of older assumptions are in this code? And the really interesting thing about that is it wasn't tickled for 20 plus years. You know, old assumptions, it's another piece of liability, I think, for this code.
Well, no, I would suspect it was crashing beforehand. It was just because this customer, because they were doing something specific and the size of their output was round about the danger number, that they actually detected it.
That's what it boiled down to. So if they did their command without the detailed keyword, it didn't crash.
Well, that's what I'm saying with old assumptions.
I can tell you that it was an EVPN show command. And, you know, when I was looking at stuff, I was doing actually similar things, not on an automated basis, but manually. I was sitting there pounding on stuff when I was teaching myself BGP. And I was doing a very similar command, but, you know, the number of NLRIs that I had in the rib was way, way smaller, and
couldn't tickle the problem, right?
Yep.
And I'm guessing that if anybody did run into this, it was randomly enough that they didn't notice, and it wasn't annoying enough. So
it was a solar storm.
Exactly. Yeah, just whatever, right? So yeah, this is one of those. I think is a classic example of I wouldn't know how we would write test cases to cover this type of thing, because you've got a huge space of, you know, a huge fault search space to fuzz against, right? And I mean, the good answer to this is like, stop issuing that.
So, doctor, it hurts when I do that. Okay, stop. Don't do that.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's.
One of the things I've been thinking about recently, sort of in this area, the fault detection space. I like the way you put that. Is that what you said, Alistair? The fault space? Like, it is effectively infinite with software of sufficient complexity. Like, there's really not a way to cover the entire fault space in any non-trivial piece of software. And so then it becomes like, what strategy do you use to approach an infinite fault space? And it's, you know, sometimes that's use case based, but I don't know, even use case based, you know, could it have possibly found this this interaction?
Yeah. So I mean, I think if you had potentially focused on unit tests somewhere in, and you know, that's where I would go looking. Maybe you could have actually written something that would test, which is relatively linear, to be able to test against, and then you can just, you know, grind through the numbers. And so you need to be back at the unit test level to see if you can find this. And the question is, was it an interaction that you wouldn't have spotted in any other way? And then you're back into, you know, high combinatorics numbers. So
yeah, why would you be unit testing that particular thing? Because part of the problem with unit testing is you can't think of everything. It'd be awful nice if we could think of everything.
The way I think of unit tests are, if I write a routine, my unit tests around that routine is going to cover the ways that I intended that routine to operate. And that way, if somebody comes in and makes use of my routine and expands it or modifies it in some way that breaks my use case, then my unit test will fail. But I can't unit test for their use case that I don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And for that matter, I didn't even know what unit tests were when I wrote this code.
Well, and you can't write a unit test for the future either. Like this was a interaction between code that was written a long time ago and something you wrote. Like that person back then could not have written a use case, a unit test to detect this. It wouldn't even be possible.
Well, again, this is an interesting forensics question about would any of the other CLI commands have crashed if we just haven't found those that would have been exacerbated by the same underlying routine, right? Yeah. So maybe there were bugs in lots of other areas and they just never showed up because of, you know, a different routine. Or maybe it was something that John had specifically, you know, messed up that was only causing the problem with his implementation. But
that's probably, you know, the safe bet there.
It could be. or you know, like in this particular case I was talking about with the Edge ERP, it was basically I stepped on the bounds of a particular range sort of, what would you say, an array that had a certain size, and I had added something that then had caused the array to go out of bounds. But most people didn't even know that array existed. And so, like, even in code review and stuff, why would you ever look for it? You don't know that it's there. So it's very difficult to a lot of times to figure out what you would look for and why.
So how long did it take the Brains Trust to actually corral this problem? It was about 3 weeks, 3 months?
A couple of weeks.
Yep. I mean, the good news is sort of in there, right? In the sense that when it becomes apparent, and at least somebody can have some mechanism of causing it to repeatedly happen, then, you know, you can get to the bottom of the problem.
Yeah, we were able to tickle it because of some forensics that we did in the support end of the organization. Mm-hmm. As far as having the tooling from the customer log the exact time and the exact command and the exact mm-hmm. output that they get up until the time of the crash. And then we also had other systems in their network that weren't being hammered on that we were able to then get the entire rib dump from.
Oh, from peers.
Yep. So we could get the entire rib dump, and then, okay, well, we know that at this time, this is the command that was run. All right, here's what the rib looks like. So then the Brain Trust was able to put that into the rib, you know, make everything look like it was going to look, and then execute that command while they had GDB running and finally track it down.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of times the only way to trust chase something like this down is by setting a breakpoint in GDB, triggering the error, and watching to see what happens, and just looking for breakpoints. And sometimes you're not so darn lucky that you can figure out what the correct breakpoint should be. It takes a while just to figure out where to put the breakpoint so that you're in the right domain so that you can figure out what the heck has just happened. You've got to get in the flow someplace, which is where having the ability to look at output and being able to see where that output comes out, where does that output come from, is so, so crucial in finding a lot of these types of problems. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this comes down to people just don't realize how complex this stuff is. They don't have any sense of these are hard problems. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people do have a really good sense of it, but that's not my impression. My impression a lot of times is people just don't realize just this stuff is, this is very complex code and it's very hard to work on.
I think it's to the credit of people who build these systems that people think that, right? That they don't understand the depth and the complexity of the solution, because for the most part, it works really well. When something works really well, you don't question, you know, why does it work? It's when it falls apart that you start wondering. And, you know, to a degree, I think we're conditioned by software that's doing a pretty good job of solving the problem. We think that the problem must be pretty simple. It's kind of an implicit human assumption, I think, but it's not.
Yeah.
This is also something that comes up when you've got more than one person writing the code. Especially in a project with as many hands that have been in this since, you know, like 0.99.3 or something was the version of Zebra when I introduced the bug. You know, think of how many hands were in the code between then and now. And if you have one single person that had written every single line of code, then yeah, they know what to look for. But I can tell you that even in languages that I do understand very well, I don't always go through every single class and routine to get an intimate understanding of what it's doing. I'm going to look at their doc strings and say, and they say, okay, well, this is what this routine does. And, you know, oh yeah, I can reuse it.
And yeah. And I think that comes down to a single word, which we often misuse, by the way, in our world, which is tech debt. We immediately, when somebody says tech debt, we immediately say, oh, tech debt is all that old legacy stuff. And that's not what tech debt means at all. Tech debt has a very specific meaning, which is that which you think you know how it works, but it actually doesn't work the way you think it works. That's really what tech debt is. Tech debt is not, oh, it's 20 years old and therefore it's bad and I need to replace it. That's not what it means. What it means is I need to go do a refactor, not just so much because it's old, but because no one really understands how this works anymore. Like there's no one with their hands in the project any longer who know how this section of the code works. Therefore, what we need to do is we need to refactor it to match new style guidelines, to match new API guidelines, to understand so that somebody sitting here now knows how this actually works. And I think that's something we often misuse the whole term of tech debt and what tech debt means from the coding side of the world in probably ways that drive coders nuts, I'm assuming. And to give some sense, by the way, of just how complex this is, what type of complexity we're talking about here, for people who may not understand, I was sitting in a large meeting the other day, and we were talking about BGP. And I was making my usual complaint about how BGP has become like, we just throw everything in BGP. Like we just, oh, let's just put it in BGP. Like, who really cares? BGP can handle it. BGP is this infinitely scalable thing that we can just throw whatever we want to at, and nobody cares because we've proven that it's infinitely scalable, in essence, is what we often think. But then I was in the middle of a conversation about something, and I said, well, do you even understand how big the BGP code is? And I was sitting there, and I said, well, I know that when I first started working on Cisco iOS software, which was years and years and years ago, that iOS Classic, as we would call it now, perhaps, or whatever you want to call it nowadays, was in the range of 250,000 lines of code, maybe 300,000. I remember the day that Cisco iOS pushed and got to 1 million lines of code. I remember the day that the commit went in, that iOS became 1 million lines of code. And there were one of the reasons that many different development things occurred inside Cisco around that time frame was that people were scared to death of million line code bases. Okay. I you know, there were projects kicked off because Cisco iOS made 1 million lines of code, modularization projects and replacements.
Somewhere in that million lines is the original source for MS-DOS.
That, yeah, probably. I don't know. But, and so I was sitting in this meeting and I said, well, you know, BGP is probably on the order of 100,000 lines of code, is a rough guess. And someone in the background sent me a message and said, no, I just looked. The commercial implementation that I'm most familiar with is 250,000 lines of code in BGP alone. Now, I haven't looked at FRR to do a line count. I know that there are well over 100 files in the FR routing implementation of BGP. I could actually look because I have a branch right here.
So you take one giant bug and you break it down into 100 smaller bugs. They're easier to work on.
That's right. There are 122 files in the current BGP implementation in FR routing. And, you know, there are operating systems that are not 122 files. The complexity is way, way, way bigger than people think it is. So, I don't know. That's kind of my thing, is that we don't have any sense. We've lost complete sense of what the complexity is that we're dealing with in many of these situations. I don't know if Alistair or John or anybody has any comments on my pontification about the complexity of this stuff.
I agree.
But getting back to your technical debt discussion, right? The rewriting stuff usually leads to more bugs in the short term, right? Because the old stuff is mature, right? So that's the sort of problem that everybody has, right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You've got that code out there, and the older it gets, the fewer people there are who understand it. And then at some point it's, oh dear, what are we going to do with this, you know, COBOL code? We need to hire a bunch of Java programmers to fix it, right? And nobody wants to touch that problem. They prefer to leave it to the next manager to go up. And
sometimes it's broken and you just don't know it.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad tells a story about when he was stationed in Washington, D.C., and he had to go across the GW Bridge on the way to wherever he was, either, or wherever he was coming from. But anyway, he said one day he's going across the bridge in the morning, and all of a sudden this tire rolled by him. And he thought, some jerk lost a wheel. He said when he got over to the other side of the bridge and hit the brakes, all of a sudden the car dipped down and he lost his left front tire. But since he was under load, the torque was keeping the front end of the car up until he hit the brakes. So it was broken a lot longer than he realized it was.
Yeah.
I think this is just the reality. There's the, I don't know if you guys have ever read it, the How Complex Systems Fail by somebody in Chicago. One of the central tenets in there was complex systems are run integrated mode. That it is, they're always in a system in a state of failure at some place in the system or other. And it's just how it is. Like it's actually normal. I think for software, especially so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, who was it that said originally, well, if software developers built buildings, the first woodpecker that came along would end civilization. And that's much more accurate description of the way things really are than we often want to imagine as being true.
Then an earthquake would be an in-service structure upgrade.
That's probably what it would come down to. I don't know. I mean, I think it's an interesting topic, and I think we don't realize the complexity and the fragility of the complexity of what we've built. And remember, you know, your network is built on top of this code.
My livelihood is built on top of this code.
Yeah. Don't be thinking that, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to have that problem because my network is well designed and look how beautiful my network is. Yeah, well, yeah. Okay, good luck with you. Because the reality is your network is still built on this code.
It worked great in the lab.
Yeah, that's
right. But back to this particular problem, right? So the customer was frustrated that it was crashing every 45 minutes. But if they'd have backed off their use, and even with it, you know, breaking every 45 minutes, their network probably wasn't going down, right? It was flapping around a bit, but their system was working. And to Tom's observation, it wasn't working perfectly, but it was dealing with the circumstances, and that's okay, right? That's why we design distributed systems.
Yeah, that's the normal way that things work, is that we build enough resiliency in that it keeps running. even though it may not be in the most ideal mode of operation.
And that's how I approach any type of engineering problem. I try to make stuff John proof. If it's John proof, it's probably Rust proof.
Well, I don't know if I would go quite that far, John, but okay. That's maybe a bridge too far. Yeah.
Kind of on the distributed systems thread again, like, you know, complex systems that where you're putting a bunch of components together to hopefully compensate for each other. In my mind, because we talked about the fault detection space being so large, the way to carve that up in my mind is you give a Venn diagram of two different systems that are interacting with each other to be providing this resilience that you want. The part that intersects between the intersection of the two, I think that's where you test. I think that's where you focus on at least system behavioral testing. I don't know if there's a practical thing out of this conversation for me. It's okay, complex systems fail, but what do I test? Because I can't test at all. Anyway, that's kind of where my thinking goes.
And the importance of canary testing and Chaos Monkey, and the importance of fuzz, right? Because we test things when they are working, not when they fail. We set up a perfect little lab and we throw stuff at it and we configure all the protocols and we say, oh, look, this works. And then we never, ever break things, not just to make sure it works when it breaks, but also to make sure we understand what broken looks like.
I break things. I had a gig at Battelle Memorial Institute for a while in Columbus, and we're actually working on this really cool device called the Magnus Blood Analyzer, and superconducting magnet and all kinds of stuff. And I'm sad to say that this destruction does not involve the superconducting magnet, but there was a worm gear involved, stepper motor driven worm gear, in order to move vials or trays of vials along this tray or along this this axis. And I remember asking the guy that was writing the code for that. I said, why don't we have physical limit switches on this? And he said, because my code knows where it's at. And I said, really?
Yeah, okay.
Hey, I want you to come down to the lab with me. And he said, okay. So came down to the lab and I reached down and I covered up the optical encoder. And I said, okay, go ahead and send that thing to the end. And he did. And this tray that weighed like 15 pounds went like 400 miles an hour to the other end of the race. It knocked the end plate off, fell over on the ground. And the guy's, the look on his face was like, well, why would you do that? And I said, it's an optical encoder.
Somebody went to McDonald's for lunch,
yeah,
and set their McDonald's drink down in front of it, or they were eating their breakfast sandwich and the little wrapper fell off, yeah, and fell into the machine, and you didn't realize that people actually eat.
So making assumptions about how things are going to fail is that's a sure way to have it fail.
Yeah, good way to plan right for failure. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I don't have much else on this. Tom, any other questions or thoughts that you want to throw out there before we wrap up and let Alistair and John go?
No, I'm good. Thanks for coming on, guys. It was really fun.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Anything from you, Alistair, other than, you know, I think you ought to close off the sides of your tent. I think you'll be more comfortable when the mosquitoes come out tonight. But that's kind of my...
California, dude. No mosquitoes over here.
Yeah, I've heard that myth.
You and must not be in Milpitas.
I know.
Exactly. Living the dream. Sunnyvale.
Nightmares are dreams too.
And John, any other things to add?
Well, I'm just happy to be on.
You don't have a blog or anything, right, John? Or you're on just on Twitter and LinkedIn, I think.
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. That's the easiest way to find me. And if I ever do come up with a blog, it'll be part of my LinkedIn profile.
Okay. And Tom is just on Twitter.
And LinkedIn.
And LinkedIn. Okay. No blog. And Alistair is no place. Alistair is in a tent in his backyard.
I'm on LinkedIn.
He's on LinkedIn. Okay.
Find me there.
Find Alistair on LinkedIn. I'm Russ White. You can find me here on The Hedge at rule11.tech on LinkedIn. I am on Twitter, but I never log in, so don't PM me or DM me on Twitter. I just don't. It's a time thing. I just don't have the time to log into every social media network in the world and check them all. And I have a personal rule.
What if you got against DeLon?
And I have a personal rule that I do not keep social media network apps on my phone. So that's like a thing with me. So anyway, well, thanks for coming and joining us for this episode of The Hedge. And we will
subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.